Our speakers tonight are Kenneth Burke and Howard Nemeroff. They tell me that they have a game plan, but they don't tell me what it is. So I'll leave it to them to show us what it is.
Well, we've come to improvise, and we trust our powers of improvising so much that we brought our collected works along and are prepared just to sit there and read to you out of them, maybe antiphonally. This was really Mr. Burke's show. I got kind of added to it the last day or two. Mm-hmm. So the idea was to see how long I could read something before Kenneth interrupted, because as we have allowed to each other, the essence of a good word man is that he wouldn't let a good explanation go unexplained. So if I explain something, you've got to cap it. So first, I got a little document who says I'm not going to get more than three sentences through. But I took the precaution of bringing some other little documents I didn't show him, as well as an essay about him, which he was allowed to read finally on his request when it got to the stage of proof, in which he said purely, that's very kind of you. Preserved your own independence at the same time, didn't you? So, what do you do, Doctor? You get your chance. You want to go
stand
now?
Do you want to sit down there?
I'll stand up. I always sit on the table because otherwise I don't have the stature.
Well, of course I have a lot of that.
This is on the question, what is man? It's minutes of the faculty meeting on the subject. I've been noticing that, you see, every discipline has a way of undercutting the others to say, I am the essential, the rest of you guys are kind of peripheral. And this never really got anywhere, but it might set somebody else off. What is man? The professor of chemistry said that was easily answered. A handful of chemicals and a lot of water, the whole business costing maybe $1.98, and that was only on account of inflation. So I remember in popular mechanics, it was 96 cents years ago. But the organization of all this stuff, said the professor of biology, gives an impression of being directed and purposive that is quite foreign to the organization of the same chemicals in other relations. Well, if you want to know what we are, said the professor of physics, the fundamental thing to get straight is that we are arrangements of atoms dancing around in mostly void. And here the professor of economics got in. If people were not paid to talk this stuff, he said, people would not talk this stuff. Man was essentially an arrangement to ensure the steady circulation of goods and services. The professor of history sighed and said that the really interesting thing about what you were calling man was not his opinions about himself, but how he came over the course of millennia to hold the opinions he did. Now the professor of neurophysiology said he would like to agree with the professor of history, but he said from a radically different point of view. Now that we understood, he said, the interior of the brain to contain neither thoughts nor words, but only neurons, it was truly fascinating to hear a body of learned men continue to talk as though, the professor of philosophy here interrupted to say that, in that event, his learned colleague in neurophysiology wasn't saying anything, he was only clicking his neurons. Any resemblance to thought would be recognized as purely coincidental. The professor of linguistic analysis here remarked, apropos of nothing at all, that the really strange thing about man was his propensity to think of the universe and himself as generated according to the rules that generated grammar, in this instance, the Indo-European ones. You want to get in there?
I want you to finish your page.
Whereupon the professor of English misquoted Samuel Johnson and Milton to the effect that when the disputes of monarchs were discussed by grammarians, they became disputes about grammar. the professor of moral theology pointed out that their question in somewhat fuller form asked by the psalmist, "What is man that thou art mindful of him?" permitted the answer to be inferred rather plainly, "Not much." The professor of anthropology observed that man was most strikingly defined as the animal having gods. No other animal, he said, did that or anything like it. One might with equal force contend, said the university librarian, that man is the animal who writes books, many of them about what is man. No other animal was known to do that either. The professor of business administration suggested here that an interdisciplinary committee be set up. Whereupon the professor of political science broke in to say that man was the animal who formed committees. That's just because of the end of the page, you know.
Well, the reason I was so happy to have this beginning was I thought I had an answer to this. You see, my difficult friend here had showed me this, and you see, the idea is this: he offered a lot of definitions. You see, in which. My definition would be among those present, and yet I have to find some way of claiming that this is the definition, as against all the other definitions. And the way I tried to work that out is this: that all those definitions, every one of them has one thing in common. Therefore, we have to move to a higher level of generalization there. And note that all of them are definitions. And what does it mean to be this defining animal? No other animals do we know of writes definitions of itself. And so therefore, despite all the differences among them, of these definitions, they're all the use of symbol systems. Everyone uses some organized symbol system to get its statement made. So therefore, I would say that by that very situation, I can turn the embarrassment of the diversity into something on my side by saying, therefore, we will define man as this symbol-using animal. And that will cover the whole blame ground of them. I mean, you say, now given a symbol-using animal, he can run committees, he can do all this and that. But this will be the overall characterization for the lot. Now, I ran across, particularly in my definition of man, which of course was I began when defining man as the symbol-using animal. I remember, by the way, we might keep in mind the overall logic of this discussion, which will doubtless get lost, but you know what we're supposed to be working on, and that is that it's a matter of language in general and poetics in particular. In other words, we're going to say, what is it that you say about this whole field, of our field, when you're just talking about the fact that we are this symbol-using animal, and what do you say when you're discussing one particular problem in the analysis of a text, and so on. And then we have to keep shifting back and forth. I've found that this has been my problem over about 50 years of teaching, and that you it's never quite resolved. If you talk to some people are interested, say, in philosophy and sociology and so on, are interested in the notion of approaching this subject from the more general point of view. That would be the equivalent of language in general. And yet, when we have our special field, where you're dealing with works in particular, and I've tried to work out more or less I wouldn't say a heroic, but a viable scheme of working back and forth between those two. What would you say about a text purely from the standpoint of it as a poem, and what would you say about it as from the standpoint of of a statement by a citizen and taxpayer who is not necessarily poet at all. In other words, he's using symbol systems. And in my definition of man, which by popular request I will now read to you, I got into this problem in the third discussing the third clause, which is where the problem really comes up in its most acute way. And as if I say, starting out step by step, now man is the symbol using animal, and that will be our first definition. And then I will say inventor of the negative. And as the, we can go on to that if you want to discuss it. I've discussed it, I think, in an earlier talk here. That is the notion that the negative is a purely linguistic invention, doesn't exist in nature. And the third, separated from his natural condition by instruments of his own making. Now that had to do with the distinction, that would really get down to the all these definitions of man as the tool-making animal. You see, it is our ability to make tools that separated us so greatly from what we would be in a state of nature. So it was when dealing with that particular clause that I ran across the notion. Some people would say, well, why not the tool-making animal rather than the symbol-using animal? And it was there that I ran into this almost maybe just formalistic answer, and that is that even in defining him as the tool-making animal, you still have a higher level of generalization there. That is, in other words, you've already using symbol systems, so let's go for what's your highest level of generalization for your definition. And that's about what the business is involved there. No point in going on to the next two stages in the definition. I wanted to get to see what the issue is there. To what extent, in other words, this is I just invite you to ask about it. I'm trying to get away from something, away with something here. The point is, does this make does it sound like a reasonable way to approach a problem like that? And is it the, can you, should you, in making a definition, try to arrive at the highest level of generalization at that stage for your definition? Therefore, shouldn't this fact that we are the specialists in symbol using be the characteristic element? On the basis of that, you can derive our aptitude, a lot of it rather unfortunate, with tool making. I mean, the very fact that you can use symbol systems produces the kind of attention whereby you can actually invent things, and particularly hand on the invention. You can tell somebody else what you've done, so on. And therefore, a statement which might be an act of genius under conditions otherwise becomes something where you can make the whole tribe the equivalent of genius in that sense. You can tell them how to sew or how to do this or that, which mere imitation they couldn't have done. The quality of attention would not be there without this prior kind of sharpening up that you get from being this kind of animal. As we go on, we'll find out that isn't by any means just an honorific thing. It's also a problematic element. I mean, because the very fact that we do have a way of bringing the non-symbolic or external reality into ourselves, making a bridge between these two realms, also implies that we have a gulf at that very same point. And in all likelihood, it's almost the basis of alienation right there before you ever get to the kinds of alienation you get in problems of property structure and so on. But at that stage, we have a homelessness in relation to nature that an organism presumably would not have, that did not have this particular genius of ours, of when I made a mild neologism, the ability for symbolicity. We will now give our friend a chance. Very quiet, right?
Well, it quashed me down. Well, one illustrative point, Lewis Mumford has this clever comparison when he's talking about the preeminence of language in making us what we are. He says, archaeologists and anthropologists tend to go for material artifacts, and when they can find some flint axe heads, they're pleased. But he said, suppose that all the words people used left little dry husks like wing covers around. You wouldn't be able to see a flint axe head because there would be all the husks of those used words around. The moment people discovered they could talk, what they must have done for millennia is talk. Great discovery. Probably at first the whole damn business didn't mean anything. You just recited enormous long chants which other people had to recite back at you exactly the same way. At least that, you know, you define your temperament by saying whether you think people did it that way or whether they first said, you are an axe, you are a hammer, you are a river, and stuff like that. I had a definition I wrote to Mr. Mumford after reading his book. I said, the way people invented language was they got together and talked it over among themselves.
Well, there's another variation on that. You know, Malinowski has what he calls Phatic communion, which he spells P-H-A-T-I-C, which is just communion by just using language, by speaking back and forth under random conditions. And I discovered that you could also work from that and say that people get together by just sitting around and chewing the fat.
My wife had a fine definition of a committee meeting, re-chewing the fat.
Well,
that bring us down to the ground, did it?
You were going to offer a few of your statements in the other business. Do you want to do that way now or not?
All right. And,
you can see how well planned this is.
I want to say in advance that this is an article which I think is a piece of, well, this is what this fellow always does. It's a marvelous piece of work, and he keeps you on your toes all the way through. And it's a piece of luck that he's given.
There may be a slight embarrassment that I keep flattering the hell out of the master, you know, who conned me into writing a piece about him.
Wait a minute, I'll move ahead here. Here's the way he flatters me. Everything is in, by speaking about Burke's writing, everything is in movement, in development, everything is always being used for all it's worth, and sometimes maybe more. The world had just come to an end just before he got those last four words on there. All right.
Yeah, well, we thought originally this might be a way to begin things, if you can take the shameless flattery with which I butter him up. The point being to see how many sentences I got through before he couldn't stand it and started interrupting. Now we're going to see that. In one perhaps accidental symbolic act, Burke expressed his essence. He had some of his early books reissued by Hermes Publications, and indeed it turned out afterward, he says he indeed named the publisher that. Hermes was originally a boundary stone, just a little rock to show you where your land left off and your neighbors began. And then he grew a face and a beard. You've seen those in illustrations in classical dictionaries. You haven't got the beard yet, but...
This'll do.
All right. And he went on to become the Roman god of boundaries, who was called Terminus. And rising still further, he became Hermes Trismegistus, thrice greatest Hermes. Was called that way because he was a king, a priest, and a prophet or legislator all at the same time, all three. The fabled author, says my source, of a large number of works called Hermetic books, most of which embody Neoplatonic, Judaic, and Kabbalistic ideas, as well as magical, astrological, and alchemical doctrines, In other words, everything and preferably all at once. In the dictionary from which I got this description of Burke in his aspect as Hermes identifies him, as Socrates does too in the Phaedrus, with the Egyptian scribe Thoth, who had the head of an ape, I believe. Who above all, it says, created by means of words, and appears sometimes as exercising this function on his own initiative, at other times as acting as the instrument of his creator. You want to jump now, or you want to wait a little?
I can wait.
That is a doubt one may properly have about any scribe whose work is imposing enough to make you wonder whether he is representing the world or proposing to replace it. Something I always worried about with respect to John Milton. I put some of my colleagues through my experiences with John Milton last term. They were all telling me that as soon as I got onto it, I would love it. I finally got back at him by explaining that they had never told me I was reading the English translation. But Milton, for instance, when he invokes his heavenly muse, claims to merit the instruction by reason of his upright heart and pure. And yet, though it's obvious that what is intended is humility, I always heard a certain obstinacy when he says upright heart and pure, and thought of it as comparable with another of his epithets, erected. Well, the doubt may be peculiarly appropriate to a philosopher who above all creates by means of words in the special sense that he creates words or takes over words, terms, terminologies, the business of Hermes to set limits. The business of the philosopher, as Socrates defined it most tersely in the Phaedrus, where he says, I guess your way of translating is merger and division. You know, separating things out or putting things together. With the further inference to be drawn that there is a way of doing this that is right. That the anecdote is very widespread. Aristotle has it too, and it's in some Chinese document I read about the emperor's butcher, who was so good he didn't need a knife. He just divided things with his hand because he divided them where nature divided them. And then you don't need a sharp edge. They'll just fall apart on you because that is right. Well, when you ask whether Mr. Burke does what he does on his own initiative or as the instrument of his creator, you get a somewhat cryptic, though certainly comprehensive, reply from his address to the Logos, where he ends, "For us, thy name a great synecdoche, thy works a grand tautology." I think I'll let you explain about synecdoche and tautology all you want from there in.
Yeah, that was a point that the I used that in a poem of mine, where the whole idea was to work up to those two unwieldy words at the end. And having used the poem several times in readings, I learned by trial and error that the best way to approach that is first explain how you're using the two words, synecdoche and tautology. I explain it along these lines, that you have to begin by softening a blow. By synecdoche, I here meant a part for the whole, and by tautology, I had in mind the dialectic fact that if all creation is the work of the original creative word, and what I'm doing here is following the step in theology, and God said, let there was, that is the creative fiat, which was the creative word. My whole method of working is to try to work from theology without any reference to the truth or falsity of it, but from the standpoint of morphology. In other words, that I could find that statements about God can be interpreted as statements about words, can be used analogically in that way. And that's where the whole problem turns up here about this whole notion of the creative word, and as that you do have a way in which this principle, which is used one way in theology, as God said, "Let there be," and there was, and the way that same thing develops in language when you set up a particular set of terms. In terms of which you see something, and insofar as people do see it in those terms, you have created that Weltanschauung, that view of the world for them. That would be the analogy. So what I did there, the actual poem, maybe I might read the poem, because it will give you some general idea of the approach that I work with with this whole idea of the word. This poem is written in a quasi-pious way, but I'm just technically dealing with this problem of the logos, the creative word, and the fact that fits into this whole idea of the symbol using animal. And I might bring out one other possible misunderstanding that I find people often have about my work. And that is, when I speak of the, although I think that from my particular field, the word is the primary area of symbolism that I must deal with, I don't by any means reduce that field to that. I think that dance, painting, music, they're all symbol systems. Every one involves this same element. People sometimes have a feeling that there's a fundamental difference between words and these other kinds of symbols. I think we are the kind of animal that approaches the world through all kinds of symbol systems, and not all of them just verbal at all. And your logos principle is a good summary for that whole idea, particularly since in the Greek, the logos itself has a much wider meaning than just word. It is the whole idea of reason and of seeing things in terms of principle and so on. So that I might suggest as to do with this whole pattern of moving to higher levels and lower levels of generalization, which underlies our whole discussion of the language in general and poetics in particular, I might read the whole thing and explain that. And when I get to these last two words, you'll have that, which is the only unwieldy words in the whole scheme. There's just a little Platonic dialectic here, and you work up to the grand synecdoche as the notion of the part for the whole, and is thy name a grand a great synecdoche? That is it. It is just this one fragment standing for the whole of the world, and I work's a grand tautology. The idea there is that if the same principle is embodied throughout a work, then it's tautological. It's repetitious in the sense that it'll be everywhere, and then so it carried that out in the standpoint of theology. If the whole universe is a creation of God, then of course God would be manifest in some way or other in every one of its parts, and you get the equivalent, the analogy of that moving into what I call a step from theology to logology, where you say if you infuse a certain structure with a certain terminology, then of course the whole structure will partake of that one genius, and therefore in that sense will be tautological. You'll be saying the same thing every turn. Hail to thee, Logos, thou vast almighty title, in whose name we conjure our acts, the partial representatives of thy whole act. May we be thy delegates in parliament assembled, parts of thy wholeness, and in our conflicts correcting one another, by study of our errors gaining revelation. May we give true voice to the statements of thy creatures, May our spoken words speak for them with accuracy, that we know precisely their rejoinders to our utterances, and so may correct our utterances in the light of those rejoinders. Thus may we help thine objects to say their say, not repressing by dictatorial lie, not giving false reports that misrepresent their saying. If the soil is carried off by flood, may we help the soil to say so. If our ways of living violate the needs of nerve and muscle, may we find speech for nerve and muscle, to frame objections, whereat we, listening, can remake our habits. May we not bear false witness to ourselves about our neighbors, prophesying falsely why they did as they did. May we compete with one another to speak for thy creation with more justice, cooperating in this competition until our naming gives voice correctly and how things are and how we say things are one. Let the word be dialectic with the way, whichever the print, the other the imprint. Above the single speeches of things, of animals, of people, erecting a speech of speeches, and above this a speech of speech of speeches, and so on comprehensively until all is headed in thy vast almighty title, containing implicitly what in thy work is drawn out explicitly in its plenitude. And may we have neither the mania of the one nor the delirium of the many, but both the union and the diversity, the title and the manifold details that arise as that title is restated in the narrative of history, not forgetting that the title represents the story's sequence, and that the sequence represents the power entitled. For us thy name a great synecdoche, thy works a grand tautology. Summing it up that way. There's one thing I might bring in there at that point, because I think it's another thing that's going to underlie, I found this a misunderstanding that underlies my whole relation to the word and the theory of the word. And in the new edition, the foreword to the new edition of an earlier book of mine, Philosophy of Literary Form, I added this notion that I think might make it should be brought out to make this clear. I take it that the symbolically tinged realms of power, act, and order, those are the three great schemes of terms that I think follow. You have a great set of terminology that develops from the concept of the act. You have a great terminology that develops from the concept of order. And you have a terminology that develops from the concept of power. They overlap somewhat, but they're all grounded, I take it, in the realm of motion, so far as empirical existence is concerned. And this realm is non-symbolic, as motion is not in itself an example of symbolic action. I mean, it's a symbolic act for a physicist to write about motion, or to work out various schemes for analyzing motion and for making things move, and so on. But but motion itself is completely outside the realm of symbolism. If you don't get that, I wish you'd bring it up in discussion for anyone when you bring it up, because it's a very important point about the whole thing I'm after. And this realm is non-symbolic, except in the sense that man, as the symbol-using animal, necessarily endows everything with the spirit of his symbol systems. I have found it necessary to emphasize this point because, over the years, my constant concern with symbolicity has often been interpreted in a spirit exactly contrary to my notions of reality. The greater my stress upon the role of symbolism in human behavior and misbehavior, the greater has been my realization of the inexorable fact that, as regards the realm of the empirical, one cannot live by the word bread alone. And though the thing bread is tinged by the realm of symbolic action, in the sense that we have a name for it, its empirical nature is grounded in the realm of non-symbolic or extra symbolic motion. In other words, it's just the bread makes possible certain mere digestive processes, the body, sheer motion in that sense. There is a basic difference between metaphysical idealism and my concern with the word. Say that you can't talk about anything except by exemplifying the rules of talk is not identical with saying that our world is nothing but the things we say about it. On the contrary, alas, there's many a time when what we call a food should have been called a poison. And if our ancestors had but hit upon too many of such misnomers, we'd not be here now. My whole feeling is the more you study this realm of symbolic action, of the terrific range of things that we do through bigness symbol using animal, the more you realize, the last analysis, it's that the answers are in the realm of the non-symbolic. And I think that's really the way this ties in with all these people who are worrying about ecology and so on. You can go on and sell yourself this idea or that idea, but if it's poison, it's poison, no matter what you call it. And that's the way it'll work out. And I think that this whole environmentalist emphasis that's coming up now just fits completely into the kind of attitude that I have here, where you have by just trying to watch the comedy of human word using, and then you see it on the edges of the terrific tragedy when you do get this misnaming. It ultimately leads you to a little vision of across the jumping off place where you just realize that words be damned. The last analysis, we live or die just as bodies. And that's exactly what we're facing in this whole issue now. We can go on and blowhorn about doing this or that, but that is the final test. Are our names accurate or are they not? See, and insofar as they're accurate, they give us a chance to pull out of this thing. Insofar as they're not, we're down the drain. But the question is ultimately in this realm. What I mean, the realm of sheer motion. Is the body being poisoned? Or is it not? No matter what he calls it. But they can call it food, they can call it the future, they can call it product, they can call anything else. Is it being poisoned or not? And are we destroying our rivers and so on, or are we not? And we can call them anything we want. That is the element. That's what I mean by the ultimately, this whole feeling of the marvels of symbolism. Every single symbolic structure, every act of genius, every great drama, every great novel and so on. There you see all this tremendous scope and mystery and genius of these works. And yet in the last analysis, it's this, are these bodies being properly taken care of or not? And that's what I mean, that is purely in the realm of motion, not action. Now the motion category looks like action because being so much the use of the symbol using animal, we endow nearly everything in the world with a symbolic content. But that's not intrinsic to the material itself. That's just the way we approach it because the particular kind of animal we are. You're allowed to go on, friend. You get a chance.
Is there some place to go? Okay. Well, I understand that you must have bit on a bad physicist or something. You're protesting so much about believing in motion. In that same book, Philosophy of Literary Form, you divided language up in uses as dream, prayer, and chart. I suppose what you mean is you mustn't contradict the chart so hard it kills you by dreaming or praying things that just aren't in the situation. That relation is a fascinating one. And Christopher Caldwell says about the tribes who do the rain dance, says they do it just before the rainy season. They don't do it in the dry season.
It's a wise time.
And as I think this guy's somewhere said, with our technology, we tend to think of it of other civilizations or primitive peoples as inferior, and yet the odd thing is just turning it around, how much nature allows for. It won't kill you off. There are many mistakes that don't kill you. Your chart can be wildly astray and full of psychotic influences. These people just go on living in the same manner. Whereas our beautiful notions have brought us quite close to the apocalypse. So that while we are saying that people thought in as the year 1000 approached, they thought the destruction of the world was imminent, and weren't they superstitious to think that? Now, as the year 2000 approaches, we think, well, it's quite reasonable. We're just allowing the extra 30-odd years for the round numbers' sake, and the whole thing might blow up in our faces then or before then. Of course, there's a nice relation there, because you can't expect the millennium until you have a calendar, and there you get your symbolism coming in.
Well, I guess a little analogy fits in there with that, Howard, in this way, too, and that is that you take, and this absolutely absurdity of the world we're in, you give somebody a couple of dollars and he can go into a supermarket and buy some food, and he feels himself so confounded superior to a primitive tribe that can make a living in a wilderness, and this ash couldn't do anything. And I use the example.
That includes us.
I think. You're right. I use the example. I think it's like a guy getting delusions of grandeur, because every time he walks into a supermarket, the doors open to himself. My God, I did that.
I made up one couplet that I beg leave to include on the situation, just to destroy everything. I came armed with lots of couplets just in case. It's called Creation Myth. I got one that's shorter than his, you see. It's on the idea of the Möbius band, where you can go from inside to outside without crossing an edge and back again. And it says, this world's just mad enough to have been made by the being his beings into being prayed. You have to think
out. It'll work out. Work out.
All right, I'll tell it to you again. This world's just mad enough to have been made by the being his beings into being prayed. You can have a copy in plain wrapper. Not the sort of thing you want to tell anybody. Time for questions from the floor, I dare say.
It might be a good chance to let someone come in at this stage. Only want to start from the other end. We can go on if we have
we'll
to.
Sure
we,
can.
We're glad to have glad to get someone from the other end. That's what we're all here for. We're ready to pop up. Want to say anything? Yes?
We should go back to the beginning and explain the interrelation between symbols and alienation.
Between symbols and what, please?
Alienation.
Alienation? Oh, well, what I was getting at there, I was saying that after you get a highly developed property structure, you can get alienation simply because of the fact that the property structure is out of line with the needs of the situation, and people lose their sense. The structure no longer seems rational to them, and whenever you've lost rationality, a sense of rationality, to that extent, you're confronting a feeling of alienation. And I think what I was getting at is that I think that the beginnings of alienation are further back. The very fact that we could develop all this elaborate departure from the mere conditions of living are involved in this thing I'm talking about. By the very fact that we spontaneously approach everything from a standpoint of a symbolic film that is between us and those things. You might put it in this way, in the simplest way for my own field. Everything, maybe you don't have a name for everything, but you think of everything as nameable. If you just, you could, if you knew enough, you'd have the name for it. So that we just approach everything from the standpoint of nameability. Yeah, go ahead.
There's a nice illustration that Mr. Burke had of the difference that I thought is definitive. He noticed one corner of the world there's a hurricane, newspapers report it. Buildings are blown down, lives are lost, crops are destroyed, land is inundated, and the newspaper said it is estimated there have been $5 million worth of damage, $5 million lost. And he says, next day, the stock market goes down, and it is estimated that the losses total $5 million. Now you can see that one set of losses is what you would call natural or real. The other has something to do with the symbol system. People haven't lost things in exactly the way that they did in the hurricane.
Yeah, to carry that out a little further, when I actually saw once, after it was after this big hurricane that went through New England.
38.
And there was and I saw an article on the financial page of the New York Times where this man writing there talked about the losses due to that hurricane up there in through New England, and there was some terrific number of billions of dollars, and this fellow says, after all, that's just about what we lost in the big market slump of 1929. Well, when the market slump of 1929, every single piece of property was there the next day. Every locomotive, every slave. There was no loss at all, you think, from the standpoint of this real realm, of just this material realm. The losses were purely symbolic, you see. Just all these twists of ownership and so on, and yet every single thing was there. And people so spontaneously think in symbolic terms in our system, they can't discount things like that. And this is the great lie. This is the great deception between us and the state of nature. Yes.
Yeah. But then, what is the link? It's probably a stupid question. What is the link then between those consequences, which were very real and not symbolic, of the stock market crash? How do you get from the symbolic loss to the very real consequences?
The fact is that so far as the place was not destroyed, you had the actual reality of the conditions. That, in other words, you still had all the resources there, and therefore people could go on living. That they had to do a lot new tricks of symbolism. I mean, for instance, the government started bailing out people who were in debt, bail them out if they had a big enough debt. If they had little debts, they weren't bailed out. They could sell apples. But anybody who was really a big railroad or something was in trouble, got bailed out. And just the way the Penn Central is getting bailed out now. The conditions are the same, but you have all these resources of symbolic manipulations, because the whole monetary structure is, of course, an example of symbolism.
And this is your instance, then, a good instance of alienation, right?
Well, here's an illustration for a change. It's not from you, but it's funny.
All right.
Thurman Arnold has a book called The Folklore of Capitalism, which used to be very popular and is still worth looking at. It was written on the basis of that depression. He said, you'd think anybody know the difference between a horse and a duck. But, he says, suppose a situation where ducks are taxable and horses aren't. Then you will find people bringing their ducks out of the barnyard and putting bridles on them, saddles, and walking them around, and proclaiming that it is obvious to anyone that this animal has been a horse from all eternity.
That, of course, is the marvelous way in which that comes to a focus and leads to alienation, isn't it? Is when the corporation was made a person, when we set up the Constitution, there were no such things as corporations. The word doesn't appear, and it was much later that all these rights that were guaranteed to the person in the individual human sense were transferred to a legal person. And when you transfer them to a legal person, you get a whole new bag of tricks which don't have anything to do with the reality of the situation. I mean, I know personally a man who simply he divided himself into two corporations, and he had the most marvelous method. He was a publisher. He would make a deal with a writer and give him a very tempting contract. But in the court, along a little clause in the contract where he could, under certain not too clearly specified conditions, could sell the rights to this to another corporation, and if he did so, there were certain changes in the schedule of royalties and so on. All he did, he was both corporations. He went and signed up this contract, this handsome contract, with a chap under one corporation, and sold it to himself, another corporation, and then went the royalties down just by using this symbolic action device. And this is one of the fundamental resources of symbolic usage, and you can see how it naturally makes for alienation. It's your turn, Howard. Huh?
Well, I was just noting we.
But somebody else. Oh, here's someone. 1 second.
I wonder if you would share a comment on your conception of man's symbolizing ability as a source of his alienation in relation, say, to Ernst de Sierre on that same idea. Do you find de Sierre to be someone important to your way of thinking?
The only basic place where I would deviate from de Sierre and his idea of the animal symbolicum is that the whole post-Kantian line. See, I make a distinction of this. So I start this theory of symbolic action. I think of primarily as starting from an idea of language, not primarily as a field of knowledge, but primarily as a field of action. As I view language as a kind of instrumentality that was developed by a tribe's modes of cooperation and competition. In other words, it was essentially ways of persuasion and dissuasion, getting people to help you on this enterprise and away from that enterprise. Don't do this, do that. But basically of that sort. And the Kantian line is what I would call dramatistic, because the essence of it is in action. And that fits in with my whole theory of poetics until also, because in that whole line, the scholastic line, act and form are equated. Act equals form. And of course, if you start to work with pieces of literature in poetry and so on, the first thing you're doing is asking about form. How does it go from here to here to here, rather than asking whether it's true or false? I don't think truth or falsity is the main test. I think that verisimilitude is a much more relevant test than truth in that particular realm. Sometimes the very fact that something is true will help it to be to have verisimilitude, but it doesn't necessarily have to work that way. But your Kantian line, which Gesira is in, it's a grand line, and I think Kant's Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics is one of the basic books. But it starts from a problem of knowledge rather than this question of action, and to that extent, I would call it scientistic rather than dramatistic. In other words, the way that turns up, and of course, in the actual history of the subject, is of course starts in epistemology, which is actually the question of knowledge. And I think that whole line has this this epistemological emphasis, which is, to me, from the standpoint of the kind of problems that I have to deal with primarily, the matters of form and dramas and so on, it's a roundabout way of getting at the subject. And I first have to ask myself, what's going on here? And how are you pointing the arrows? How are you getting people to expect this and be gratified by that and resent, want this character to get bumped off, want this character to be saved, and things like that? And you get a whole group of dynamic questions that develop that way, and you see it work going. If you start from the knowledge end, I think you do a much better job. You're much more direct there if you're just dealing with scientific nomenclatures primarily. This scheme starts with poetic problems, not scientific problems. Now, it becomes scientific in the sense that anything you say, insofar as what you say is accurate, it's a contribution to knowledge. But it's the question of where do you go into it? How do you get into the whole subject?
I think we ought to get on to what we agreed was your colophon. I could introduce it with one thing. It occurred to me that poetry is like a very eccentric filing system.
Since our time is up, I have, as I was telling my friend Howard Nimeroff, I've always found that when you this is particularly a good poem to end on after you've been in a conference for 3 days. I found then that it almost goes over extremely well, but even maybe an hour will be good enough to do that. It's called On Putting Things in Order. File this, throw out that, alert the secretariat, id re each claim and caveat, to better serve the cause of alphabet. Throw out this, file that, file this, throw that out. We know beyond all doubt how perfect order reconciles, and now throw out the files, huh? Let's go home.
Go.
Thank you.